Chapter 4. The Wound. Little Billy's mother was always telling him exactly what he was allowed to do and what he was not allowed to do. All the things he was allowed to do were boring. All the things he was not allowed to do were exciting. One of the things he was never, never allowed to do, the most exciting of them all, was to go out through the garden gate all by himself and explore the world beyond. Roald Dahl, The Minpins. In the clearing stands a boxer and a fighter by his trade, and he carries the reminders of every glove that laid him down and cut him till he cried out in his anger and his shame, "I am leaving, I am leaving," but the fighter still remains. Paul Simon, The Boxer. I believe I was the only one in the entire company to come all the way through Normandy without getting wounded. Private William Craft, 314th Infantry Regiment. The story of Adam's fall is every man's story. It is simple and straightforward, almost mythic in its brevity and depth. And so every man comes into the world set up for a loss of heart. Then comes the story we are much more aware of, our own story. Where Adam's story seems simple and straightforward, our own seems complex and detailed. Many more characters are involved, and the plot is sometimes hard to follow. But the outcome is always the same, a wound in the soul. Every boy, in his journey to become a man, takes an arrow in the center of his heart, in the place of his strength. Because the wound is rarely discussed, and even more rarely healed, every man carries a wound. And the wound is nearly always given by his father. On a warm August afternoon several years ago, my boys and I were rock climbing in a place called Garden of the Gods, near our home. The red sandstone spires there look like the dorsal fins of some great beast that has just surfaced from the basement of time. We all love to climb, and our love for it goes beyond the adventure. There's something about facing a wall of rock, accepting its challenge, and mastering it that calls you out, tests and affirms what you are made of. Besides, the boys are going to climb everything anyway, the refrigerator, the banister, the neighbor's grape arbor, so we might as well take it outside. And it's an excuse to buy some really cool gear. Anyway, when I climb with the boys, we always top rope, meaning that before the ascent, I'll rig protection from the top of the rock down, enabling me to belay from the bottom. That way, I can coach them as they go, see their every move, help them through the tough spots. Sam was the first to climb that afternoon, and after he clipped the rope into his harness, he began his attempt. Things were going well until he hit a bit of an overhang, which, even though you're roped in, makes you feel exposed and more than a little vulnerable. Sam was unable to get over it and began to get more and more scared the longer he hung there. Tears were soon to follow. So, with gentle reassurance, I told him to head back down, that we didn't need to climb this rock today, that I knew of another one that might be more fun. "No," he said. "I want to do this." I understood. There comes a time when we simply have to face the challenges in our lives and stop backing down. So I helped him up the overhang with a bit of a boost, and on he went with greater speed and confidence. "Way to go, Sam. You're looking good. That's it. Now reach up to your right. Yep, now push off that foothold. Oh, nice move." Notice what a crucial part of any male sport this sort of shop talk is. It's our way of affirming each other without looking like we're affirming. Men rarely praise each other directly as women do. "Ted, I absolutely love your shorts. You look terrific today." We praise indirectly by way of our accomplishments. "Oh, nice shot, Ted. You've got a wicked swing today." As Sam ascended, I was offering words of advice and exhortation. He came to another challenging spot, but this time sailed right over it. A few more moves and he would be at the top. "Way to go, Sam. You're a wild man." He finished the climb, and as he walked down from the back side, I began to get Blaine clipped in. 10 or 15 minutes passed, and the story was forgotten to me. But not Sam. While I was coaching his brother up the rock, Sam sort of sidled up to me and in a quiet voice asked, "Dad, did you really think I was a wild man up there?" Miss that moment, and you'll miss a boy's heart forever. It's not a question. It's the question, the one every boy and man is longing to ask. Do I have what it takes? Am I powerful? Until a man knows he's a man, he will forever be trying to prove he is one, while at the same time shrink from anything that might reveal he is not. Most men live their lives haunted by the question, or crippled by the answer they've been given. In order to understand how a man receives a wound, you must understand the central truth of a boy's journey to manhood. Masculinity is bestowed. A boy learns who he is and what he's got from a man or the company of men. He cannot learn it any other place. He cannot learn it from other boys, and he cannot learn it from the world of women. The plan from the beginning of time was that his father would lay the foundation for a young boy's heart and pass on to him that essential knowledge and confidence in his strength. Dad would be the first man in his life and forever the most important man. Above all, he would answer the question for his son and give him his name. Throughout the history of man given to us in Scripture, it is the father who gives the blessing and thereby names the son. Adam receives his name from God and also the power of naming. He names Eve, and I believe it is therefore safe to say he also names their sons. We know Abraham names Isaac, and though Isaac's sons Jacob and Esau are apparently named by their mother, they desperately crave the blessing that can only come from their father's hand. Jacob gets the blessing, and nearly a century later, leaning on his staff, he passes it on to his sons. He gives them a name and an identity. You are a lion's cub, O Judah. Issachar is a raw-boned donkey. Dan will be a serpent. Gad will be attacked by a band of raiders, but he will attack them at their heels. Joseph is a fruitful vine. His bow remains steady. The Baptist's father names him John, even though the rest of the family was going to name him after his father, Zechariah. Even Jesus needed to hear those words of affirmation from his father. After he is baptized in the Jordan, before the brutal attack on his identity in the wilderness, his father speaks, "You are my son, whom I love. With you I am well pleased." Luke 3:22. In other words, "Jesus, I am deeply proud of you. You have what it takes." One father-naming story in particular intrigues me. It centers around Benjamin, the last son born to Jacob. Rachel gives birth to the boy, but she will die as a result. With her last breath, she names him Benoni, which means son of my sorrow. But Jacob intervenes and names him Benjamin, son of my right hand. This is the critical move when a boy draws his identity no longer from the mother, but from the father. Notice that it took an active intervention by the man. It always does. A boy is brought into the world by his mother, and she is the center of his universe in those first tender months and years. She suckles him, nurtures him, protects him. She sings to him, reads to him, watches over him, as the old saying goes, like a mother hen. She often names him as well, tender names like my little lamb or mama's little sweetheart or even my little boyfriend. But a boy cannot grow to manhood with a name like that, let alone a name like son of my sorrow. And there comes a time for the shift when he begins to seek out his father's affection and attention. He wants to play catch with dad and wrestle with him, spend time outside or in his workshop. If dad works outside the home, as most do, then his return in the evening becomes the biggest event of the boy's day. Stacy can tell you when it happened for each of our boys. This is a very hard time in a mother's life, when the father replaces her as the son of the boy's universe. It is part of Eve's sorrow, this letting go, this being replaced. Few mothers do it willingly. Very few do it well. Many women ask their sons to fill a void in their soul that their husband has left. But the boy has a question that needs an answer, and he cannot get the answer from his mother. Femininity can never bestow masculinity. My mother would often call me sweetheart, but my father called me tiger. Which direction do you think a boy would want to head? He will still turn to his mother for comfort. Who does he run to when he skins his knee? But he turns to dad for adventure, for the chance to test his strength, and most of all, to get the answer to his question. A classic example of these dueling roles took place the other night. We were driving down the road, and the boys were talking about the kind of car they want to get when it comes time for their first set of wheels. I was thinking about a Humvee or a motorcycle, maybe even a tank. What do you think, Dad? I'd go with the Humvee. We could mount a machine gun on top. What about you, Mom? What kind of car do you want me to have? You know what she said? A safe one. Stacy is a wonderful mother. She has bit her tongue so many times I wonder that she still has one, as she holds her peace while the boys and I rush off to some adventure begging destruction or bloodshed. Her first reaction, a safe one, is so natural, so understandable. After all, she is the incarnation of God's tenderness. But if a mother will not allow her son to become dangerous, if she does not let the father take him away, she will emasculate him. I just read a story of a mother, divorced from her husband, who was furious that he wanted to take the boy hunting. She tried to get a restraining order to prevent him from teaching the boy about guns. This is emasculation. My mom wouldn't let me play with G.I. Joe, a young man told me. Another said, we lived back east, near an amusement park. I had had a roller coaster, the old wooden kind, but my mom would never let me go. That is emasculation, and the boy needs to be rescued from it by the active intervention of the father or another man. This kind of intervention is powerfully portrayed in the movie A Perfect World. Kevin Costner plays an escaped convict who takes a young boy hostage and heads for the state line. But as the story unfolds, we see what looks like the boy's ruin is actually his redemption. The boy is in his underpants when Costner abducts him. That is where many mothers want to keep their sons, albeit unconsciously. She wants her little lamb close by. Over the days that follow, days together on the road, I might add, Costner and the boy, who has no father, grow close. When he learns that the boy's mother has never allowed him to ride a roller coaster, Costner is outraged. The next scene is the boy, arms high in the air, rolling up and down country roads on the roof of the station wagon. That's the invitation into a man's world, a world involving danger. Implicit in the invitation is the affirmation. You can handle it. You belong here. There comes a moment when Costner buys the boy a pair of pants. The symbolism in the film is amazing. But the boy won't change in front of him. He is a shy, timid boy who has yet to even smile in the story. Costner senses something. What's the matter? You don't want me to see your pecker? It's puny. What? It's puny. Who told you that? The boy, Philip, is silent. It is the silence of emasculation and shame. The absence of the father's voice is loud and clear. So Costner intervenes and speaks. Let me see. Go on, I'll shoot you straight. The boy reluctantly bears himself. Now, Philip, that's a good size for a boy your age. A smile breaks out on his face, like the sun coming up, and you know a major threshold has been crossed for him. Masculinity is an essence that is hard to articulate, but that a boy naturally craves as he craves food and water. It is something passed between men. The traditional way of raising sons, notes Robert Bly, which lasted for thousands and thousands of years, amounted to fathers and sons living in close, murderously close, proximity. While the father taught the son a trade, perhaps farming or carpentry or blacksmithing or tailoring, my father taught me to fish. We would spend long days together, out on a boat, on a lake, trying to catch fish. I will never, ever forget his delight in me when I'd hook one. But the fish were never really the important thing. It was the delight, the contact, the masculine presence gladly bestowing itself on me. Attaboy, tiger. Bring him in. That's it. Well done. Listen to men when they talk warmly of their fathers, and you'll hear the same. My father taught me to fix tractors, to throw a curveball, to hunt quail. And despite the details, what is mostly passed along is the masculine blessing. Fathers and sons in most tribal cultures live in amused tolerance of each other, says Bly. The son has a lot to learn, and so the father and son spend hours trying and failing together to make arrowheads or to repair a spear or track a clever animal. When a father and son spend long hours together, which some fathers and sons still do, we could say that a substance almost like food passes from the older body to the younger. This is why my boys love to wrestle with me, why any healthy boy wants the same with his father. They love the physical contact, to brush against my cheek, feel the sandpaper of my whiskers, my strength all around them, to test theirs on me. And it's that testing that is so essential. As they've gotten older, they love to start punching matches with me. Luke just did it this morning. I'm downstairs fixing breakfast. Luke senses the opportunity, and he sneaks downstairs and silently stalks me. When he's in range, he lets loose a wallop. It hurts, and they need to see that it hurts. Do they have a strength like Dad's? Is it growing, real, substantive? I'll never forget the day when Sam gave me a bloody lip, quite by accident, when we were wrestling. At first, he drew back in fear, waiting, I'm sorry to admit, for my anger. Thankfully, on this occasion, I just wiped the blood away, smiled, and said, "Oh, nice shot." He beamed. No, he strutted. Shook his antlers at me. Word quickly spread through the house, and his younger brothers were on the scene, eyes wide at the fact that one of them had drawn blood. New possibilities opened up. Maybe young bucks can take on the old bull. The ancient societies believed that a boy becomes a man only through ritual and effort, only through the active intervention of the older men, Bly reminds us. The father or another man must actively intervene, and the mother must let go. Bly tells the story of one tribal ritual, which involves, as they all do, the men taking the boy away for initiation. But in this case, when he returns, the boy's mother pretends not to know him. She asks to be introduced to the young man. That is a beautiful picture of how a mother can cooperate in her son's passage to the father's world. If she does not, things get very messy later, especially in marriage. The boy develops a bond with his mother that is like emotional incest. His loyalties are divided. That is why Scripture says, "For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife." Genesis 2:24. Sometimes, when the mother clings, the boy will try to tear himself away, violently. This typically comes in teenage years and often involves some ugly behavior, maybe some foul words on the part of the young man. She feels rejected and he feels guilty, but he knows he must get away. This was my story, and my relationship with my mother has never been good since. I found that many, many adult men resent their mothers but cannot say why. They simply know that they do not want to be close to them. They rarely call. As my friend Dave confessed, "I hate calling my mom. She always says something like, 'It's so good to hear your little voice.' I'm 25 and she still wants to call me her little lamb." Somehow, he senses that proximity to his mother endangers his masculine journey, as though he might be sucked back in. It is an irrational fear, but it reveals that both essential ingredients in his passage were missing. Mom did not let go, and Dad did not take him away. Whatever the mother's failure, it can be overcome by the father's engagement. Let's come back to the rock climbing story with Sam. "Did you really think I was a wild man up there?" He did not ask, "Do you think I'm a nice boy?" He asked about his strength, his dangerous capacity to really come through. A boy's passage into manhood involves many of those moments. The father's role is to arrange for them, invite his boy into them, keep his eye out for the moment the question arises, and then speak into his son's heart, "Yes, you are. You have what it takes." And that is why the deepest wound is always given by the father. As Buechner says, "If strangers and strange sights can shake the world of children, it takes the people they know and love best to pull it out from under them like a chair." Dave remembers the day the wound came. His parents were having an argument in the kitchen, and his father was verbally abusing his mother. Dave took his mom's side, and his father exploded. I don't remember all that was said, but I do remember his last words. "You're such a mama's boy," he yelled at me. Then he walked out. Perhaps if Dave had a strong relationship with his dad most of the time, a wound like this might be lessened, healed later by words of love. But the blow came after years of distance between them. Dave's father was often gone from morning till night with his own business, and so they rarely spent time together. What is more, Dave felt the lingering disappointment from his dad. He wasn't a star athlete, which he knew his dad highly valued. He had a spiritual hunger and often attended church, which his dad did not value. And so, those words fell like a final blow, a death sentence. Leanne Payne says that when the father-son relationship is right, the quiet tree of masculine strength within the father protects and nurtures the fragile stripling of masculinity within his son. Dave's father took an axe and gave his hardest blow to his young tree. How I wish it were a rare case, but I am deeply sorry to say I've heard countless stories like it. There's a young boy named Charles who loved to play the piano, but his father and brothers were jocks. One day they came back from the gym to find him at the keyboard, which had built up years of scorn and contempt in his father's soul, but his son received both barrels. You're such a faggot. A man my father's age told me of growing up during the Depression. Times were hard for his family, and his father, an alcoholic rarely employed, hired him out to a nearby farmer. One day while he was in the field, he saw his father's car pull up. He hadn't seen him for weeks, and he raced to meet his dad. Before he could get there, his father had grabbed the check for his son's wages and, spying the boy running toward him, jumped in the car and sped away. The boy was 5 years old. In the case of violent fathers, the boy's question is answered in a devastating way. Do I have what it takes? Am I a man, Papa? No, you are a mama's boy. An idiot. A faggot. A seagull. Those are defining sentences that shape a man's life. The assault wounds are like a shotgun blast to the chest. This can get unspeakably evil when it involves physical, sexual, or verbal abuse carried on for years. Without some kind of help, many men never recover. One thing about the assault wounds, they are obvious. The passive wounds are not. They are pernicious, like a cancer. Because they are subtle, they often go unrecognized as wounds, and therefore are actually more difficult to heal. My father was in many ways a good man. He introduced me to the West and taught me to fish and to camp. I still remember the fried egg sandwiches he would make us for dinner. It was his father's ranch that I'd worked on each summer, and my dad and I saw a lot of the West together as we'd make the long drive from Southern California to Oregon, often with fishing detours through Idaho and Montana. But like so many men of his era, my father had never faced the issues of his own wounds, and he fell to drinking when his life began to take a downhill turn. I was about 11 or 12 at the time, a very critical age in the masculine journey, the age when the question really begins to surface. At the very moment when I am desperately wondering what it means to be a man and do I have what it takes, my father checked out, went silent. He had a workshop out back, attached to the garage, and he would spend his hours out there alone, reading, doing crossword puzzles, and drinking. That is a major wound. As Bly says, not receiving any blessing from your father is an injury. Not seeing your father when you are small, never being with him, having a remote father, an absent father, a workaholic father, is an injury. My friend Alex's father died when he was 4 years old. The sun in his universe set, never to rise again. How was a little boy to understand that? Every afternoon, Alex would stand by the front window, waiting for his father to come home. This went on for almost a year. I've had many clients whose fathers simply left and never came back. Stuart's dad did that, just up and left, and his mother, a troubled woman, was unable to raise him. So he was sent to his aunt and uncle. Divorce or abandonment is a wound that lingers because the boy, or girl, believes if they had done things better, Daddy would have stayed. Some fathers give a wound merely by their silence. They are present, yet absent to their sons. The silence is deafening. I remember as a boy wanting my father to die and feeling immense guilt for having such a desire. I understand now that I wanted someone to validate the wound. My father was gone, but because he was physically still around, he was not gone. So I lived with a wound no one else could see or understand. In the case of silent, passive, or absent fathers, the question goes unanswered. Do I have what it takes? Am I a man, Daddy? Their silence is the answer. I don't know. I doubt it. You'll have to find out for yourself. Probably not. Every man carries a wound. I have never met a man without one. No matter how good your life may have seemed to you, you live in a broken world full of broken people. Your mother and father, no matter how wonderful, couldn't have been perfect. She is a daughter of Eve and he a son of Adam. So there is no crossing through this country without taking a wound. And every wound, whether it's assaultive or passive, delivers with it a message. The message feels final and true, absolutely true, because it is delivered with such force. Our reaction to it shapes our personality in very significant ways. From that flows the false self. Most of the men you meet are living out of a false self, a pose, which is directly related to his wound. Let me try to make this clear. The message delivered with my wound, my father disappearing into his own battles, was simply this. You are on your own, John. There is no one in your corner, no one to show you the way, and above all, no one to tell you if you are or are not a man. The core question of your soul has no answer and can never get one. What does a boy do with that? First, I became an unruly teen. I got kicked out of school, had a police record. We often misunderstand that behavior as adolescent rebellion, but those are cries for involvement, for engagement. Even after God's dramatic rescue of me at the age of 19, when I became a Christian, the wound remained. As my dear friend Brent said, becoming a Christian doesn't necessarily fix things. My arrows were still lodged deep and refused to allow some angry wounds inside to heal. I mentioned earlier that for years I was a very driven man, a perfectionist, a hard charger, and a fiercely independent man. The world rewards that kind of drivenness. Most of the successful men reading this book are driven. But behind me was a string of casualties, people I had hurt or dismissed, including my own father. There was the near casualty of my marriage, and there was certainly the casualty of my own heart. For to live a driven life, you have to literally shove your heart down or drive it with whips. You can never admit need, never admit brokenness. This is the story of the creation of that false self. And if you ask my wife during the first 10 years of our marriage if we had a good relationship, she probably would have said yes. But if you had asked her if something was missing, if she sensed a fatal flaw, she would have immediately been able to tell you, "He doesn't need me." That was my vow, you see. I didn't need anyone. After all, the wound was deep and unhealed, and the message it brought seemed so final. I am on my own. Another friend, Stan, is a successful attorney and a genuinely good guy. When he was about 15, his father committed suicide, stuck a gun in his mouth, and pulled the trigger. His family tried to put it all behind them, sweep it under the rug. They never spoke of it again. The message delivered by that gruesome blow was something like this. Your background is very dark. The masculine in your family cannot even be spoken of. Anything wild is violent and evil. The effect was another sort of vow. I will never do anything even remotely dangerous or risky or wild. I will never be like my dad. How many men live with that vow? I won't take one step in that direction. I will be the nicest guy you ever meet. You know what? He is. Stan's the nicest guy you could meet. Gentle, creative, caring, soft-spoken. And now, he hates that about himself. He hates the thought that he's a pushover, that he won't take you on, can't say no, can't stand up for himself. Those are the two basic options. Men either overcompensate for their wound and become driven, violent men, or they shrink back and go passive, retreating men. Often it's an odd mixture of both. Witness the twin messages sported by young college-age men especially. A goatee which says, "I'm kind of dangerous," and a baseball hat turned backward which says, "But really, I'm a little boy. Don't require anything of me." Which is it? Are you strong or are you weak? Remember Alex, who stood at the door waiting for a daddy who would never return? You wouldn't in a million years have guessed that was his story if you'd known him in college. He was a man's man, an incredible football player, a hard-drinking, hard-living man every guy looks up to. He drove a truck, chewed tobacco, loved the outdoors. He used to eat glass. I'm serious, it was sort of a frat party trick he took on, the ultimate display of dangerous strength. He'd literally take a bite out of a glass, chew it slowly, and swallow it. When he worked as a bouncer for a tough bar, it made a pretty impressive show to get the roughnecks in line. But it was a show, the whole macho man persona. Charles, the artistic boy, the piano player whose father called him a faggot, what do you think happened there? He never played the piano again after that day. Years later, as a man in his late 20s, he does not know what to do with his life. He has no passion, cannot find a career to love, and so he cannot commit to the woman he loves, cannot marry her because he is so uncertain of himself. But of course, his heart was taken out, way back there in his story. Dave is also in his 20s now, drifting, deeply insecure, and loaded with a great deal of self-hatred. He does not feel like a man, and he believes he never will. Like so many, he struggles with confidence around women and around men he sees as real men. Stuart, whose father abandoned him, became a man without emotion. His favorite character as a boy was Spock, the alien in Star Trek who lives solely from his mind. Stuart is now a scientist, and his wife is immensely lonely. On and on it goes. The wound comes, and with it, a message. From that place, the boy makes a vow, chooses a way of life that gives rise to the false self. At the core of it all is a deep uncertainty. The man doesn't live from a center. So many men feel stuck, either paralyzed and unable to move, or unable to stop moving. Of course, every little girl has her own story, too. But I want to save that for a later chapter and bring it together with how a man fights for a woman's heart. Let me say a few more words about what happens to a man after the wound is given. Chapter 5, The Battle for a Man's Heart.